You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of February 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Al Jazeera's Peter Gresty is home, having been freed from his absurd prison sentence in Egypt. His two colleagues, however, remain in jail in Cairo. I'll be joined by Daniela Pellet and James Schneider to discuss this and the day's other top stories. Later on in the show,
it's just beyond this door.
What is?
My playroom.
Like your Xbox and stuff?
Rated R.
We'll preview what's screening at the 65th Berlin Film Festival, which starts tomorrow. All that, plus a check-in with our woman in Delhi and a review of London's latest theatre openings. That's all coming up right now on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but ahead of all that, David Spencer has the latest news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. Jordan has executed two Iraqi prisoners with links to Islamic State militants following the murder of a Jordanian pilot who is being held by the extremists. King Abdullah has returned to Jordan from the United States, vowing to wage a relentless war against the extremists in Jordan. Islamic State militants released a video on Tuesday of Mu'ath al-Kasaba being burned alive. Jordanian government spokesman Mohammed al-Mamani says ground troops will not be used against IS in Iraq or Syria.
We're talking about helping the Iraqi military. We're talking about helping the Syrian moderate opposition or a Peshmerga troops in order to fight on the ground. But we are talking about a collaborative effort between coalition members in order to intensify our efforts and work to stop extremism and terrorism.
15 people have miraculously survived a crash of a TransAsia Airways plane in Taiwan. The aircraft, carrying 58 passengers and crew, came down shortly after takeoff in Taipei. Dramatic pictures show the plane lurching between buildings, clipping a taxi on a road, before then crashing in shallow water. 23 people are confirmed to have died, 20 though are still missing. Emergency rescue officials have been searching the partially submerged fuselage for survivors. Chad's army says it's killed more than 200 militants from Boko Haram in fighting in northeastern Nigeria. It says 9 of its soldiers were killed. The fighting has taken place around the towns of Gambaru and Nungala. The Pope has called for fresh talks between the government of Ukraine and pro-Russian separatists in the east of the country. Speaking in his weekly general audience of the Vatican, the Pope called the conflict a war between Christians. In the last 24 hours, more than 20 civilians and 2 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed in the fighting. Up to 10 people have been killed after a shell hit a hospital in the rebel-held city of Donetsk. Peter Gresty, the Al Jazeera journalist, freed after more than a year in an Egyptian prison, has arrived back home in Australia. He was released on Sunday after 400 days in a Cairo jail and flew back to Brisbane from Cyprus, where he's been since the weekend. Gresty's case attracted widespread attention and criticism of Egypt's leadership and judiciary. He was greeted by a cheering crowd at the airport.
I can't tell you how ecstatic I am to be here. This is a moment that I've rehearsed in my mind at least 400 times over the past 400 days. And it feels absolutely awesome to be here with my family, with you guys. But of course, this is all tempered, and I'm going to say this a million times, this is tempered by a real worry for my colleagues, for Mohammed Fahmy, for Baher Mohammed, for all of the other guys that were imprisoned alongside us.
The chief executive and other senior management at Brazil's Petrobras have resigned amid the continuing corruption scandal. The firm's board of directors will meet on Friday to elect a new management team to replace the CEO and 5 other senior executives. Petrobras shares climbed on Tuesday after reports emerged that President Dilma Rousseff had decided to replace the top management. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's 18.05 here in London, which is 13.05 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news, we have in the studio Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and contributor to Haaretz, among others, and James Schneider, editorial director at New African Magazine. We will start tonight in Jordan, which has paid the first installment of its promised vengeance for Islamic State's murder of captured fighter pilot Lieutenant Moaz Al-Kazazba. Jordan has executed two Islamist convicts, one of whom was failed suicide bomber Sajida al-Rashawi, who was at one point proposed as an exchange for Lieutenant al-Kazazba. Daniela, I'll ask you first. For all sorts of obvious reasons, difficult to divine the thinking, such as it is, of Islamic State. But is this really likely to bother them one way or the other?
I think they're in a win-win situation, if it isn't horribly cynical to describe it that way, because what's facing Jordan now is the issue of whether it will redouble its efforts, so to speak, to be part of the Arab coalition against ISIS, or whether people will say, why are we involved, as they already have done, why are we involved in this war? This isn't our war. This is an American thing. We don't want to get involved. I mean, either way, it's good for ISIS. I mean, that carries on with its strategy globally. If the West rises up to attack it, great. If it doesn't, also great. I mean, the thing is, though, that Jordan is frightened. I mean, Jordan is very, very frightened. It's got one of the highest numbers of all of the Middle Eastern countries of ISIS volunteers. It's geographically extremely vulnerable. It wasn't at the start of, you know, the Arab Spring uprisings 4 years ago. It wasn't the most solid of states, and I'm not sure about vengeance. I mean, the executions are sending a very strong message, I think less to ISIS, but more to Jordanians, saying we'll do something, we'll protect you, we won't let this go unavenged.
Is this, James, the difficulty that King Abdullah now has, trying to figure out where his subjects are between wanting to redouble efforts against ISIS or even keener than they already were not to get involved with this at all?
Yes, I think he's in a very difficult position, which is likely to get harder with, as Daniela says, ISIS have quite a few supporters within Jordan, and they issued this list of names of people that they put bounties on their heads with their addresses within Jordan. And it seems like they are, you know, furthering their efforts to make life very difficult for the Jordanians. And I don't think I mean Jordan's response in executing these people is clearly for domestic consumption. It's not really anything to do with ISIS, because ISIS, I don't think, could care less. The female suicide bomber who was part of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, it's even an organization that part of which became ISIS, but it's before ISIS. They don't really care about this person. They were just trying to get her to be freed for Kenji Goto, I think, so they could, you know, to make life even more difficult, to demonstrate, like, we'll make you pay $200 million in ransom. We'll make you give us a suicide bomber. I think it's a show of strength. And they, you know, the tit for tat is not benefiting, is not really damaging ISIS at all.
Daniela, you said there, and rather depressingly, I think you're entirely correct, that this is something of a win-win situation for ISIS, at least as it plays out over the next few days. But, and again, it's never the easy question trying to fathom quite what their end game or their strategic logic is. But are they actually trying to provoke some sort of all-in conflagration in the Middle East? They really are behaving like people who want a ton of bricks, or actually a ton of, or several tons indeed, of even more dangerous commodities to come raining down upon them.
I think without a doubt, that's exactly what they would like. I mean, look at the effect on morale with one Jordanian pilot. I mean, he was killed in an incredibly appalling way. But just imagine if something similar happened with other members of the coalition attacking. Imagine if as we get more and more drawn in, imagine the possibility of ground troops. I mean, they're fighting an enemy with really not even paying lip service to the Geneva conventions or anything of that kind. I mean, the idea is escalation in Iraq and Syria, And I'm sure they'll be delighted if there are acts like the Charlie Hebdo killings. Anything inspired or anybody who wants to join their name to the increasingly powerful brand. Thing is, I mean, I have been perhaps unfashionably in favour of intervention in Syria for a long time, and perhaps it's too late now. But short of very muscular intervention, it's hard to see what will actually make a dent in this. But then the risks that anybody involved in military action is just getting higher and higher.
Because James, we are now in a very weird area. The murder of Lieutenant Al-Kasasba was far from the first atrocity ever perpetrated against a prisoner of war. But when they've happened generally throughout military history, people have either attempted to cover them up, apologised for them afterwards, made some show of... They are not only contriving the most grotesque and extravagant atrocities they can think of, they're then boasting about them.
Yeah, they're recording them in high definition. And I think that that is the difference. And with they've got a lot of other tricks up their sleeve. I think ISIS pretty much is able to control the narrative. With the hostages, for example, previously it has been thought that if you don't publicise the people who have been taken hostage, it makes it more likely that you'll be able to negotiate their return. But at the moment, not that I'm suggesting that we should publish a list of everybody that we think ISIS has, but the fact that ISIS does, one imagines, have some number of hostages from other countries, that as soon as a political move is made by another country, they can then issue a retort, control the narrative entirely again, and make the fight against them look like they control it.
But on that thing you were mentioning there, Daniela, the prospect of intervention, of sending or somebody sending troops to deal with them, and I for one suspect there probably wasn't all that much doubt about it, but the murder of Lieutenant Al-Kasasba and the manner of it is a demonstration, if not a boast, that there is no point in even attempting to negotiate with these people, isn't it?
No, I think so. I mean, it also sends a message. I mean, this is a high-profile Sunni Muslim victim executed in a way. I mean, they just seem to be having to bump up the stakes and become more and more and more shocking, just when you've reached the point where you can't be shocked anymore. This comes along, and some elements, i.e. Fox Media, of the Western media are helping them do that. But as I said before, support in Jordan for the battle against ISIS was fairly lukewarm to begin with, and any extra efforts that are going to be made, how can you really win a war like this from the air? You can't. But the idea of sending in ground troops, events like this make it even more unthinkable, even if that is the only thing that will make a difference. I mean, the idea is now, what the reason why this ideology and why the group is flourishing is because you've got a power vacuum in Syria and Iraq, and nothing but the reversal of that is actually going to make a fundamental difference in the long run.
Final thought on this, James. Daniela was talking about some of the more excitable Western coverage of this most recent ISIS atrocity. A lot of, as this campaign of murder of hostages has continued, a lot of media outlets are making a point of not showing any even stills from the videos. Several executions ago, they were at least showing still photos, and now most people aren't even doing that. But does that actually make any difference to an organisation which is broadcasting through social media?
No, I don't think it really does. And I mean, whilst the Western media may not be showing the full graphic details of the Jordanian pilot who was burnt alive, the Jordanian media is showing almost all of it, almost up to the end. And as we've seen with ISIS, they've got reasonably sophisticated media distribution, and that's how they're communicating with people. And it's enough that we, who are not their target audience in terms of support, but target audience in fear, we know it's happened. We don't actually have to see it to generate that fear.
Okay, well, let's move along now to a less discussed front in the struggle against Islamist extremism, but arguably a bloodier one, the aspirations of Nigerian-based group Boko Haram of creating their own militantly ignorant caliphate in West Africa appear to have been dealt a blow by Chad's decision to join the fight against them. Chad claims that its soldiers killed more than 200 Boko Haram foot soldiers in retaking Gamboru, a small town in Nigeria's northeast. 9 Chadian soldiers were reported killed. James, why has Chad joined in?
Chad's been involved in smaller ways for a while. Boko Haram does operate within Chadian territory. Boko Haram operate mainly in Nigeria, but in the Kanuri-speaking bits of Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. And Chad has, in the last few years, demonstrated itself to have the kind of the best and the strongest military and the largest will within the region, dealing with different sort of Islamist militant groups. And beforehand, they were dealing with Boko Haram on their side of the border. They would attack, but the coordination was quite limited. And since the Baga massacre, and since Abu Bakr Shekau, the head of Boko Haram, said that he was going to attack Cameroon much more, Cameroon went to Chad and said, okay, will you help us? Will you use your both ground troops and air support when they're launching attacks in Cameroon? And now Chad, it looks like the first time they went in was possibly unilaterally to retake territory from Boko Haram within Nigeria. And that's the big thing, at least from the Nigerian perspective, is the Chadian military is going into Nigeria to retake territory that has been taken that the Nigerian military cannot do, using tactics that the Nigerian military should be able to and doesn't, namely, air support for ground defences, because the Nigerian response or approach has mainly been highly reactive, as in you get attacked, you run away, you maybe come back a bit, and not using any air force whatsoever.
Daniela, is it hoping too much? And I think I can guess the answer to this question, that various countries surrounding the Islamic State in the Middle East might look upon this example of regional cooperation among West African countries to deal with an Islamist insurgency in their midst and learn from it?
Well, right, I'm trying to ramp down my cynicism here. But the reason, as James said, the reason Chad has acted now is because it threatens its own interests. It exports much of its oil through Cameroon, and so this is not out of some sort of benign or let's all try this together. I mean, that would be fine in the Middle East if people were acting according to their sort of wider regional interests as well. Well, what's clear is that the Nigerian army simply can't do the job. It can't, from what I understand, it can't even begin to do the job. I mean, it's one of the reasons why things have got to such an awful state. A mass corruption. The fact it just doesn't work. I mean, it just doesn't work. And it's too big an army to be able to not work, if you see what I mean. The failure of being so big and failing
is
immense. It sounds
not dissimilar to the Iraqi military in that respect.
Well, in the running away respect, I think all armies that just run away when they're attacked probably got quite a lot of similarities.
Yeah, I think there simply isn't a Chad-type equivalent anywhere in the Middle East, because there wouldn't be allowed to be a Chad equivalent. So Chad uses its sort of military might to prop itself up, to play a kind of outsized regional role, meddles in the affairs of others, but fundamentally can fall back on the fact that its enemies are hated by powerful interests from the outside more than its meddling is. And there isn't really an equivalent that can basically get up one day and say, we're going to invade a country, or we're going to go into Nigeria, we're going to go into Cameroon, we're going to do what we think needs to be done. And if anyone tells us to stop, as they did in Mali and as they did in Central African Republic, they'll throw their toys out the pram and look for the next time to get involved.
Strange enough, I can think of one actor in the Middle East that might be able to do that. Perhaps has done in the past.
Indeed so. On that happy note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellet and James Schneider. When we return, we will be discussing Al Jazeera journalist Peter Grester's overdue homecoming.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story. Sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming up for 21 minutes past the hour. Still with me, Daniela Pellid and James Schneider. Now, he called it, a moment he had rehearsed in his mind at least 400 times over the last 400 days. That was Al Jazeera's Peter Grester back home in Brisbane, having been freed from a long and ridiculous captivity in Egypt. He was rightly quick to note, however, that the two colleagues imprisoned alongside him on no less absurd charges, Mohamed Fahmy and Baha Mohammed, are still in jail in Cairo. Daniela, first of all, has Egypt just finally been embarrassed into letting him go, or do they think they've made their point, whatever that was?
Well, both. I mean, they have. They have made their point. They've made their point very well. And all of this jubilation over his release, and it's fantastic that he has been released, and it was very unjust that he was imprisoned in the first place, kind of helps obscure the fact that there are literally tens of thousands of political prisoners who have been detained since Sisi came to power. And, you know, I do understand that we have to make alliances and we have to be pragmatic in the West about human rights and so on and so forth. We have to be realistic. But when you see the incredibly warm reception that Sisi got at Davos, for instance, I mean, now he's been accepted into the family of strong leaders. Thank you very much.
Meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Yeah, but even worse in a way, because we had an idea of how things could be different and people wanted things to be different and are now in prison because they wanted things to be different. So, yes, I mean, it is a fantastic news that he's been released. And I think another one of the journalists who has a dual Canadian citizenship is likely to be released. The poor chap who is only an Egyptian citizen, I think prospects for him are less cheering. But I think it's very important to remember that this isn't actually a victory for press freedom in Egypt. I mean, nothing close to it.
Is it arguable, James, if we're going to get really depressed and cynical about this, that it's kind of a defeat for press freedom in Egypt? Because, as I'm sure the Egyptian authorities are well aware, once they've basically released the White Western guy, all of a sudden an awful lot of media are going to cease paying attention.
Yes, and I think that's quite the point. They've not been embarrassed, the Egyptian authorities. They've not been forced into doing this. They've had no climb down, exactly as Daniela said. I mean, the kind of fulsome praise that Sisi's had since his coup from John Kerry, Catherine Ashton, Tony Blair, the whole Davos crew, means that, you know, okay, he got some bad press in some Western papers that he doesn't care about holding Peter Grester. But this is a win for him. There have been huge amounts of really good reporting into the black site prisons, the mass arrests, the mass executions. Not the executions haven't happened yet, but being condemned to being executed. And really, it hasn't impacted him either domestically or in terms of his regional policy. So I think Sisi can probably just view this as an act of beneficence on his own that doesn't actually affect him at all. And that, I think, should really be a condemnation in how everyone has engaged with Sisi's administration since he came to power in July 2013.
But is there, all of which is pretty much inarguable, but Daniela, is there another way? I mean, this thought has certainly struck me the other week when we saw the leaders of the world's democracies rushing to Riyadh to pay tribute to, you know, I mean, the obvious point is the obvious point. Do we have to keep pretending we like these people? I mean, you know, if you take the pragmatic realpolitik view that, okay, fine, maybe they're there holding back something that would be worse and maybe stability is better than instability, but Do we have to keep pretending we like them?
We have to pretend a bit, I think.
Because they know we don't.
We have to pretend a bit. I mean, there are commercial interests, there are diplomatic interests, and we have to be realistic about it. But I think the flying of flags at half mast and the sort of warm embraces, I think that is... I think we shouldn't pretend to a completely nauseating point. And I think we should still expect a little bit of a quid pro quo, you know, a little bit of movement on human rights, a little bit back. I mean, we seek stability at all costs, and I think that's an enormous mistake.
Yeah, I think the Abdullah thing is obviously really hateful and distasteful, but it is different to Cesius, and I can understand some of the logic behind it, even though I oppose it, because the entire way in which Saudi recycles its petrodollars into buying US debt holds up the basis of the global economy as it is currently structured. So that, you know, a lot of people depend on that, not necessarily all in positive ways. But Sisi, I am slightly baffled by it, because it's not as if the EU, for example, really needs this kind of very unpleasant, hardline, militaristic regime in order to make sure that Egypt functions in some kind of manner. It doesn't quite make sense in the same way. It's not as crucial to the interests, to the perceived interests of the Western world, as much as, you know, the sort of horrible show of ingratiating yourself to the Saudi royal family.
No, I have to disagree a little bit, because I think it is seen as crucial. You know, Egypt is the largest Arab nation. The situation in the Sinai is, you know, the security situation there is deteriorating immensely fast. And, you know, back to Israel, the idea that the peace with between Egypt and Israel is really a linchpin of stability in the Middle East. And so I think really there's the West will go quite far to welcome Sisi. But yeah, I think it's just the extent is just really, really troubling.
Well, finally, tonight, the producers of an Angolan soap opera have been obliged to apologise to viewers after broadcasting an episode in which two men were shown kissing, if you can imagine such a thing. The programme Jikulu Mesu, which often tackles social issues, is produced by a company owned by the son of the president. The contentious moment sounded like this.
O que vou dizer, eu adorei estar contigo aqui. Eu vou querer repetir isso muitas vezes. Tens a minha promessa.
It's amazing that civilization has survived that moment.
There goes all of Monocle 24's Angolan listeners.
Well, indeed. James, do we have any idea how widespread outrage was, or was just as it usually is in most countries, you know, like four half-witted cranks with nothing better to do ringing in to complain?
Yeah, it might have just been a few angry letters to Ofcom's equivalent. The fact that the president's son owns the company is an interesting point. That might be a sort of minor embarrassment, but this may have been an attempt. I don't know enough about the details. This may be an attempt to have some kind of social change through television, because there have been a few. For example, there was an MTV program called Sugar in Kenya, which had a gay storyline, which was in a quite activist manner, trying to change perceptions of young people. So it may have been that kind of got entered into it before the son of the president realised, and, you know, dad told him off.
I mean, Daniela, it would be pleasant to think that it is something that will fall away in the next few decades, as it has in the West in the last few decades, but homophobia remains a huge thing in Africa. Homosexuality is a criminal offence still in much of the continent.
Yeah, I don't think Angola is the worst place to be gay in Africa, but it's not far from the best place. I think a lot of places have very contradictory laws, you know, that theoretically uphold human rights but make homosexuality illegal. I don't think in Angola this has been upheld.
No, homosexuality is legal in Angola.
Yeah. So it's troubling. I mean, we see this rightly as one of the sort of indicators of how far a country is along in its sort of embrace of human rights, democracy, rule of law. Social change takes a long time, but I do think soap operas can be quite a driver of this. I was just reminiscing about the famous lesbian kiss in Brookside. What was that, 1991, perhaps? Everyone made such a fuss.
They really did.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, perhaps 20, 25 years hence, people in Angola will be baffled as to what the Jakulu-Mesu scandal or Jakulu-Mesu gate or something of that ilk was ever all about. On that note, we will have to leave it there. Daniela Peled and James Schneider, thank you both very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио, Monocle 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
And lots still coming up in the second half of today's show. We'll be speaking to our woman in Delhi. We'll preview the 65th Berlin Film Festival, and we'll have Matt Wolfe here in the studio to review London's latest theatre openings. Ahead of all that, David Spencer is here with the headlines.
Thank you. Jordan's King Abdullah has vowed a relentless war against Islamic State militants in his country. His comments come a day after the group released a video appearing to show a captured Jordanian pilot being burned alive. A United Nations report has listed a range of abuses of Iraqi children by IS militants. It says children from the Yazidi sect or Christian communities, but also Shiites and Sunnis have been victims. Rescue workers continue to search for survivors of the Trans-Asia Airways plane that crashed into a river in the Taiwanese capital, Taipei. The crash killed at least 23 of the 58 passengers and crew on board. 15 people, though, survived. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras says he's confident of a deal on its debt as he continued meetings across Europe with leading figures. After talks with the European Commission, he's held talks with French President François Hollande. Greece is looking to renegotiate the terms of its huge bailout. Australian journalist Peter Grester has arrived in Brisbane and repeated his call for the release of two of his colleagues still in custody in Egypt. The Al Jazeera employee was freed at the weekend after more than a year in jail in Cairo. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David Spencer. Welcome back to Midori House, live on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 just now in Moscow, 18:32 in London, 16:32 in Rio. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we're going to Delhi, from where I'm joined by Arti Bettigheri. Arti, good evening. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you tonight, Marcus?
I'm all right. I'm doing fine. We're 3 days out of the Delhi elections on the 7th. What is Delhi like in election season?
Oh, it's hellish. You know, there are major traffic jams all over the city because each of the parties insists on having dozens, if not hundreds, of rickshaws that they've customised into being these election vehicles. So they drive around, they're covered in the party bunting, and they've got loudspeakers. They drive around the suburbs and the streets, clogging up the traffic and blasting their election slogans. It's driving everyone mad. And I don't think I'm alone in saying I cannot wait for these elections to be over.
Explain a bit, I guess, about local elections in Delhi. Are they elections which tend to actually be about local things with local peculiarities, or is it like akin to local elections and by-elections in the United Kingdom, where they're generally an opportunity to give the national government a bit of a kicking?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting point, because I think it would be really tempting to see these as a kind of report card, as it were, on the performance of the BJP government at the national level. But really, these are about local peculiarities, the local issues. And, you know, Delhi, like all regions in India, has its own peculiar baggage. And this baggage here is a man called Arvind Kejriwal. Now, he's the leader of the Aam Aadmi Party. Aam Aadmi translates to common man, so that gives you an idea of where they're coming from, their resource. It's the party that grew out of the anti-corruption movement from a few years ago, so it's still pretty new. But they made such a splash on the Delhi stage when they lasted for elections in late 2013, which is not a very long time ago, you know, just over a year ago. They made such a splash, they actually gained governance and lasted 49 days.
As long as that.
After 49 days. Yeah, an anti-corruption bill. But now they're back and bigger than ever, and, you know, they think they're going to win. And, you know, the people I've spoken to seem really lethargic about voting now. But who knows? They could well get in. I mean, Congress at the Delhi level is not really a contender. The BJP is. They've got a really interesting candidate, a woman called Kiran Bedi. Interestingly, she just switched sides. She used to be in the Aam Aadmi Party. She was one of the founders of it. But she's a former policewoman who's quite renowned for having these really progressive policies when it came to the treatment of prisoners. But at the same time, she's got a lot of support, but at the same time, there's a lot of scepticism around her because she's been publicly found out to have lied about certain things that have made her look good.
Okay, well, I want to move on to a more national story. India, of course, prides itself on the reputation as the world's largest democracy. However, it does have occasional and often quite capricious limits on freedom of speech, and somebody, as I understand it, has wandered across them.
I mean, it's just another example of this kind of constant chipping away at freedom of speech, but it seems to almost be a kind of a self-censoring. Now, this case, there's this group of comedians called All India Bakchod, which kind of loosely translates to, and this is the polite version, shameless idiot. They put up this three-part YouTube series where they roasted, A-list Bollywood celebrities. And the celebrities, yeah, because they were in on it and laughing away at the insults being hurled at them. They were, quite happy to be there. And, the whole point was to kind of pull them down off their pedestals because the whole of India really does take Bollywood and the actors and actresses in it, excessively seriously. And massively popular. It was watched something like 8 million times. But then the conversation seemed to have been co-opted by right-wingers who said the jokes were too base, too harsh, and, that the creators needed to apologise, and it's kind of spun out to this big thing. Now, the overarching theme here is that the fringe hardline elements in this country are continuing to suppress freedom of speech, whether it's talk about the sex lives of gods and goddesses or just poking, good public fun at Bollywood actors. So, there is this underlying threat and fear of violence, and no one wants that, and, anything could spark it. So that's why people are taking the decisions themselves to pull down the videos or whatever it is, self-censor.
Okay, now I want to move finally along to a business story, and this is the news that an Indian smartphone manufacturer, Micromax, has overhauled Samsung on the domestic market. And that obviously makes Micromax an absolutely enormous company, India being the size of mobile phone market that it is, and yet few people outside India, I suspect, know much about them.
Yeah, it's a fairly new company, Micromax. It's based in India, just outside of Delhi, but the phones are made in China. And, they've really branched out to quite a number of different types of smartphones. They hired Hugh Jackman to do their advertising and TV. They really plowed a lot into marketing their phones, and it did work. They've been involved in cricket and whatever. They've overtaken Samsung, Samsung itself took over from Nokia a few years ago. So it's a pretty dynamic mobile phone market in India at the moment. There are a lot of phones being sold, I think, in the quarter to December, the one that Micromax won with 22% of the market share. 22 million mobile phones were sold in that quarter. So, if nothing else, that does show that there is plenty of room for everyone.
How much of their appeal is due to the fact that they are able to sell themselves as the local brand?
It's more about price. They've just gotten the price point right. I mean, they're selling, decent smartphones with a good range of features that are durable and will last, a year or whatever, for under $100. And Indians are really price conscious. So, yeah, they've just hit upon that sweet pricing point.
Aarti Bedagiri in Delhi, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be previewing the 65th Berlin Film Festival, which starts tomorrow.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. The 65th Berlin Film Festival, or Berlinale, gets underway tomorrow. The event has traditionally been geared to arthouse films, but this year it might be two blockbusters that steal a lot of the attention of festival goers. The one is Disney's Cinderella. The other one, and I can scarcely contain my excitement, is 50 Shades of Grey. Telling us more and previewing the festival on the whole is the Daily Telegraph's Tim Robey. Tim, welcome back to the programme. 50 Shades of Grey, on a scale of 1 to Shoot Me Now, how bad is it?
I feel like I've already been shot because I've started reading it. I've been instructed to read it, and it's honestly... Words fail on the page constantly.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I have barely proceeded. I've got to the same point with 50 Shades of Grey that I did with The Da Vinci Code, which was out of idle curiosity, sort of reading the first two paragraphs in an airport bookstore. Dan Brown, I think, is probably the worst writer, but is it having sort of sampled more of the book? I mean, which do you think is the worst?
Well, the number of paragraphs that begin, holy crap, kind of speak for themselves in this. I'm just wondering how well it's going to translate to film. Can they make a film as badly made as the book is written? That's the question mark. I mean, it's strange that they're premiering it in Berlin. Berlin, I've been going for years, and it's a sort of, sometimes it's a slightly sort of freezing wasteland of rather niche interest, kind of Euro-erotic art movies. And now they're bringing us 50 Shades of Grey, which is kind of the mainstream version of same. I don't know how it's going to play. It's the kind of world's attention is going to be concentrated on it for this one day when it premieres there, because it's there a day before it comes to London, etc., etc.
Okay, well, we have a clip of it, so we can hear from ourselves how bad at least 30 seconds of it is.
Mr. Grey will see you now.
Do you have any interests outside of work?
What about you? I'd like to know more about you.
There's really not much to know about me. Look at me. To what do you owe your success?
I exercise control in all things, Miss Steele.
Yep, sounds awful. 50 Shades of Grey, the film version thereof. We'll move along from that to a film which I'm actually genuinely quite excited about seeing. This is Werner Herzog's Queen of the Desert, not to be confused with Priscilla of the same name. This is a biopic of the extraordinary Gertrude Bell, who does have... It's the kind of life story you wouldn't dare make up, even if you were trying to write a somewhat over-the-top matinee thriller. Is it something you can compress successfully into a film?
Well, if anyone can do it, one would hope Werner Herzog can. You know, he goes to the end of the earth with his films. And this is one that he's cast with big names. It's Nicole Kidman as Gertrude Bell, James Franco and Damian Lewis rounding out the cast. I'm always impressed with Nicole Kidman's kind of willingness to work with some quite sort of out there directors in her time. She's worked with like Lars von Trier and Jonathan Glazer and people like that. And I'm just hoping this one comes together. I have a good feeling about it.
The last film in which she played an actual real life person, of course, which was Grace, has not generally been adjudged to be her finest couple of hours, he said, understating matters wildly.
That is very true. And even her Oscar winning Virginia Woolf, I think, is not her finest hour, despite the Oscar. But I don't know. I have a good feeling around this one. And it's great to have a Herzog film back in Berlin in the main selection, main competition. I think, you know, this looks like a highlight to me.
Okay, well, we have a clip of Queen of the Desert.
Mr. Wiley.
Richard. Please say Richard.
Richard. I'm not ready. I would never be with...
Would never what?
I would never be with a man again.
It sounds a little bit like 50 Shades of Grey with a name change.
I was just going to say exactly that. I really hope that doesn't suck, because it is just the most fantastic, extraordinary life. And this will probably be, given the size of the budget and the size of the names, this will be the Gertrude Bell film.
I expect so. It might just be that one scene that sucks. We can always hope.
I really, really hope so. A film that you have seen, Andrew Haig's 45 Years.
This is tremendous, actually. It's okay. The guy who made Weekend, the kind of gay love story a few years ago. It's his next one. It stars Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtney as a long married couple who realize that there's something kind of in their marriage that they've never really owned up to. There's a secret he's never revealed. And they discover this on the eve of their 45th wedding anniversary, and it sort of chills their whole marriage to the core, basically.
So Charlotte Rampling's playing a bitter, thwarted, middle-aged woman.
She starts out playing a perfectly contented middle-aged woman, which is an unusual departure for her. But
I know.
You see it kind of eat away at her. She's really good, though, and I think Courtney has not had as good a role in many years. I thought this was excellent, and Andrew Haig wrote it as well. It's very kind of, it's adapted from a short story, very kind of economically done, really moving. I think it deserves comparison to a film like Amour, actually. Not a barrel of laughs, but really strong.
So that's likely to get people excited at Berlin, you think?
Well, I imagine it could get some acting attention for the two of them as well, because they do give out awards at the end. You know, Charlotte Rampling could well win Best Actress for that performance. I think since that French film, Under the Sand, which was probably about 15 years ago now, I don't think she's been quite as dominant in a film and quite as impressive. And it is a different side from her. She's not sort of the sort of witchy Black Widow kind of figure that we sometimes get. She's kind of very subtly passive aggressive, and I think she gets a certain type of British way of dealing with a crisis where you just snipe away at it and mention it occasionally, and you know, clearly your entire life has changed and been ruined.
Finally, and fairly briefly, if you would, it's not usual to see documentaries in competition at Berlin, but Patrizio Gutzmann is having a crack at it with The Pearl Button. Briefly explain what it's about and if we should see it.
The reason I'm excited about this one is that it's a companion piece to his amazingly good film from about 3 years ago called Nostalgia for the Light, which is about the disappearances in Chile and the recent history of that very kind of vexed nation. And this is the companion piece. It's 80 minutes long. He's an absolute master of the form. It's in competition. I think it could well be amazing.
Tim Robey from the Daily Telegraph, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. It's time now for a spot of music. We're continuing with music from Berlin. This is George Levin here with I Got Somebody New. George Levin there with I Got Somebody New. Now, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming up for the end of the show, which means it's time for our daily arts review. Today, we're talking theatre, and we're talking it once again with Matt Wolfe, critic with the International New York Times. Matt, welcome back to the programme.
Thank you.
The first one you wanted to talk about was Tom Stoppard's The Hard Problem, which, if I've done my research right, is his first full-blown West End production for 9 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, my trouble is with this is that 9 years ago I attended his last West End production, Rock and Roll, and I'm honestly not sure I recall a longer evening.
Well, then you won't be rushing to this one, Andrew. I'm not sure you'd be rushing to this one anyway, to be absolutely honest. Although, whatever your problems with it, length probably wouldn't be one of them, because strangely, this show is about half the length of Rock and Roll. It's about an hour and 40 minutes, which must rank it as amongst Stoppard's shortest plays.
Was Rock and Roll really only 3 hours, 20 minutes long? Man, it seemed like a lot longer. I went as a major fan of Stoppard. That's why I was all the more bewildered by it.
Well, this is very different, which doesn't necessarily mean better or worse, it just means different. The thing about Rock and Roll was that a lot of people thought that was Stoppard writing about himself. The central character was this Czech guy who then comes to England, a little bit like Stoppard. This has nothing to do with that. The central character in this is a young woman who's 22 when the play starts, and the hard problem of the title has to do with consciousness. And the play is really a sort of scientific debate in which these sort of abstractions of science are held up against goodness, kindness, and whatever, and we see 100 minutes later which prevails.
There's not going to be a sword fight, is there?
I don't think there are any sword fights. There's a fair amount of quasi-nudity.
Okay, well, that's something. Does it actually work? Is this a riveting hour and 40 minutes?
It didn't work for me. The funny thing about it is you feel as if Stoppard's done his homework. What he hasn't really done is write a play. So he's interviewed a lot of people, all of whom are quoted at great length in the program. There are interviews with Richard Dawkins and so on. And the research is there, but research doth not necessarily drama make. And at the end, you think, great, where's the actual drama? He hasn't located it.
Okay, well, moving along then to a much ballyhooed appearance on the London stage by one of your proper stars. This is James McAvoy in The Ruling Class at Trafalgar Studios. Was this slightly more exciting?
Yeah, this is a lot longer though, Andrew. So you might be sort of shifting in your seat.
And the sword fight count, just so we're clear on this?
Sword fight count, nil. Nudity count, not bad.
Okay.
James McAvoy does ride a unicycle at one point in his pants. However, this is the first revival, as far as I'm aware, certainly in London, of a defining play from 1968 that was made into an acclaimed movie in 1972 with Peter O'Toole. And first of all, you have to hand it for James McAvoy for deciding to do this. The last play he did on the West End a couple of years ago was the Scottish play, I guess. I don't know, can we say the title? And that's a play that everyone does. This is a play that no one does. And it's a very kind of odd, quirky piece about a paranoid, schizophrenic aristocrat who is cured of his mental illness, and in being cured of his mental illness, discovers his innate capacity for cruelty. So it's really a play about class warfare that suggests, as you can tell from the title, The Ruling Class, that those of us who are not the ruling class are probably not in a very good place.
Okay, we will come back to the fascinating and perplexed subject of Britain's class system shortly, but we do have a clip. This is from The Ruling Class.
This is 1888. I'm a red jack. Spring-heeled Jack. I am God. Not the God of love, but God Almighty!
That's from The Ruling Class, currently featuring James McAvoy at Trafalgar Studios. As you said, it was originally written, performed in the 1960s. Does it still resonate now? And I ask that because though I've lived in this country for 25 years, I'm as confused by the class system as I was when I first stepped off the aircraft. But it has struck me that in the last few years in particular, it's become more of a thing again, I think, revived by things like a conservative government led by a proper posh Tory, financial collapse, royal wedding, etc., etc. Does this feel like a play for the moment?
Well, you've absolutely nailed it. I'm sure one of the reasons why Jamie Lloyd, who directed it very well, I have to say, decided to do it is that even though in its kind of attitude and its structure, it's a little bit kind of hippy-dippy and it kind of throws everything at the wall to see what sticks. It feels very period, very Joe Orton. But in its concerns, as you say, it feels very up to the minute. There was a play at the World Court a couple years ago called Posh that was made into a movie called The Riot Club. And it's exactly the same theme as that. As you say, we are not the 1% who are ruling the rest of the world. They are, and we are impotent against their power. And the play is very angry, and I think this revival is tapping into that anger.
So, worth seeing?
I would say so, if you can stomach the long sit.
Okay, well, that's The Ruling Class at Trafalgar Studios. Finally, you wanted to talk about Dara at the National Theatre.
Yeah, now, I'm always interested in theatre, Andrew, in the vagaries of timing, okay? So Dara opened the night before The Hard Problem. The Hard Problem, as you rightly say, gets all the attention, Stoppard, blah, blah, blah. Here's a play that has kind of slipped in under the radar. For my money, infinitely more interesting, infinitely more rewarding. It will be seen by many fewer people. It's a Pakistani play that was originally done in Pakistan, that's been adapted, translated by an English writer named Tanya Ronder, and it's really interesting. It's about two warring brothers in the Mughal Empire in 1659, but what it's really about is religious fundamentalism then and now, and it's very much a play for our time.
Well, that rather tiresomely has become a recurring theme of the modern era now. Is Dara suggesting that it's what we're experiencing now is the same problem reincarnated, or does it suggest that it is a thing that has developed?
I think it suggests that it was ever thus. But what the first act of the play results in with incredible power is a really phenomenally well-done trial scene, which I actually think is one of the great trial scenes I've seen on a stage, right up there with, you know, The Merchant of Venice, which has a great trial scene. And, you know, is it saying something new? Perhaps not, but it's saying something that certainly needs to be said again and again with great clarity and compassion. It's also beautifully directed by Nadia Fall, a rising young director at the National, wonderfully designed by Katrina Lindsay. It's an evening of complete theater in a way that The Heart Problem never begins to be.
And is a ready familiarity with 17th century Pakistani court politics necessary? Or
well, I can hardly lay claim to being an expert in any of that. But what I like to do, maybe Tom Stoppard actually got me trained for this, is I go to the theater half an hour before and I swat up on my program.
Matt Wolff, critic with the International New York Times, thank you. That final selection, Dara, at the National Theatre, which sounds worth seeing. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie, research by David Pleasant and Max Koshik and Alia Masood. The studio manager was Christopher Grimes. Up after the headlines, Monocle's business programme, The Entrepreneurs, is back with Daniel Giacopelli at 2200 The Monocle Daily with myself and Emma Nelson. Midori House returns same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.